The House Transportation and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum. Let's see, Representative Barr, Regina, would you be willing to give us a motion on the minutes, please?
Thank you, Chair Runbeck. I move that we approve the minutes.
All right, Representative Barr moves approval of the minutes from the February 1st meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes of February 1st are approved. Okay, our first bill today is House File 135, and Representative Fenton, do you want to give us the story here? Welcome, Representative.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. House File 135 is a study, a safety improvement study with congestion relief for the 494-694 interchange at I-94. So with that, I have some members of Washington County as well as Woodbury that would like to testify on behalf of this bill.
So very good. Do you want to call them all up?
Sure. I'll have if the testifiers want to come up to get in line. But I do want to just give you some data, some numbers that I pulled from 2011 through 2015 in terms of the number of accidents at this interchange was a total of 517 in that from 2011 through 2015. So this, as you're going to hear today, a long-term plan for the safety improvement of this interchange happens to be the second most highly traveled interchange in the state of Minnesota, and you'll hear why this is really important.
And Representative, I'll move the bill, House File 135, and it'll be moving on to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right.
And welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today for the support of House Bill 135. My name is Stan Karwoski. I'm a Washington County Commissioner from District 2, which this freeway interchange resides in District 2. I had the fortune to come here and testify 2 years ago on the same project. The importance of Interstate I-94 to the Twin Cities and the East Metro cannot be understated. The freeway serves as a gateway to the Twin Cities from the entire eastern United States. It's a corridor of significance. It's a commuter route that's of very high significance from the east, connecting workers also from two states of Wisconsin and Minnesota, and providing transportation to jobs all across the metro area. The corridor is also a major freight route. This system interchange is the first and most important decision point for anyone entering the metro area from the east. Using this interchange, freight can access the entire south metro area via 494, the entire north metro area via 694, or serve the heart of the Twin Cities via I-94. However, there is a problem. This interchange was originally designed 50 years ago in the mid-60s. And when it was built in the 70s, traffic volumes were a fraction of what they are today. I must point out, I grew up on the east side of St. Paul and took this route to college when it was first built, and you had more of a chance of seeing perhaps a cow crossing the freeway than another car on it in those early years. So this is the this 50-year-old cloverleaf interchange design has served our region well for many years, but the cloverleaf style that was very common in the early days of the interstate system often used to manage, it was managed at junction, managed the junction of two freeways. Their biggest drawback is the weave area that becomes congested and break down at higher traffic volumes. This is what we are seeing happen today, and now the interchange design is outdated and simply does not accommodate the almost a quarter million vehicles all directions come through this interchange. As Representative Fenton pointed out, the 517 crashes, but the trend line, more importantly, is going up at a rapid pace. I've been a 29-year resident of Oakdale and have noticed the trend line going up, and 14 years on the City Council actively knowing this is a big concern for not only Oakdale but Woodbury. In addition to the outdated cloverleaf design, there are other challenges. Radio Drive is a busy six-lane arterial serving Woodbury and Oakdale to the east, and it has less than a half a mile from that freeway ramp down to this cloverleaf. And then in addition, 10th Street to the north and Tamarack to the south of the interchange are of a similar distance, you know, a half mile to a mile distance, creating backups. And finally, Century Avenue to the west. This is a major trunk highway 120, and again, it feeds Oakdale, feeds 3M Complex, and that's our international headquarters for 3M. So MnDOT does have a plan to widen the weave and add the lanes. This will improve the overall operations and capability of the interchange in a short-term way. We applaud MnDOT for acknowledging the importance of this interchange to the East Metro and the Twin Cities. But now we think that is not enough for the long-term solution. So this could be more of a to hold us over. So we applaud the new vision that is needed for the interchange, a plan that will serve us for the next 50 years in the future. That is what the HF 135 does. It directs MnDOT to study this area and develop a plan, a vision for the future. This is important because without a vision, we cannot continue to grow as a region. We won't be able to attract new jobs and businesses. We won't be able to serve the existing businesses like the worldwide headquarters of 3M. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to discuss this important interchange today.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Karwoski.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. Please give us your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
My name is Paul Renke, currently the mayor of Oakdale. And briefly, okay. I've got a 10-year history of a council member with Oakdale, recently being appointed to serve out the mayor term. The comments that Commissioner Karwoski made are very appropriate, and I'll echo those on the long term. My comments will be brief with five or six points. As Commissioner Karwoski talked about, the congestion at this intersection is extremely congested, many times at peak, grinding to a halt. One of the implications of that is that our fire department in Oakdale has typically two calls a day or two calls a week to this interchange, and the response time gets sacrificed tremendously. Specific average daily traffic totals blew me away. 694, 94, 77,000 cars. 494, 94, 84,000 cars. 94 and 694, 494, 82,000 cars. So the tremendous levels of traffic causes the problem. I applaud and encourage the longer-term visioning that's going to take place, and specifically support the HF 135 bill. As a side note, there's a Commerce story where my nephew happens to be a Long Road truck driver. Just a month and a half ago, prior to my knowledge about this bill, he was complaining to me at Christmas about coming from Canada, trying to get to Chicago, doing everything possible that he can to avoid this interchange. And the issue didn't become the time. The issue became the crazy drivers between his colleagues on the truckers doing weird stuff, trying to avoid this, and the residents. So it becomes a significant safety issue. Madam Chair, thank you.
Very good. I'm certain we all have stories. I think we are so familiar with this interchange for sure.
Yes.
So thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome, sir. Please give us your name for the record. And
thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and committee members. My name is John Bradford. I am the city engineer for the city of Woodbury. And first, I'd like to say that I concur with the gentleman before me that permanent improvements are needed to this intersection. I also want to thank MnDOT for their efforts to bring forward the improvements that they have slated. It's a significant project that in the short term will make things much safer along that corridor. You know, I'm not going to repeat any of the statistics that the gentleman before me said. They're the same ones that I have. But I think that a visioning process through MnDOT to look at what this corridor needs between Century and Radio Drive and 10th and Tamarack is essential, and we need to involve all of the stakeholders in this because it will have significant impacts to the entire region. It's definitely needed, but it's an expensive project. And, you know, one of the key things that we need is solid, steady transportation funding as a whole. And Woodbury is in support of that and in support of studying these improvements.
Mr. Bradford, perhaps you or someone else, but so we're hearing that there's some short-term and then a need for a vision for the long-term. So could we get a little more understanding of what is happening in the short-term?
Sure. In the short-term, what MnDOT is proposing to construct what they call buffer lanes, which is essentially making the bridges one lane wider to provide safer merging. And you know, slightly higher speeds can be maintained on the throughways by doing that. The improvements extend north all the way up to 10th Avenue in Oakdale, and south a little ways past the bridge. One of the big things that we like to see addressed in this is the weave between Tamarack entrance ramp and the exit for eastbound 494. It's very congested. There's a huge amount of traffic, and it's a confusing weave, and we're hoping to work with that as well. You know, in the long term, it's likely to be the flyover ramps that are hugely expensive if you really want to fix the congestion problems there.
Very good. And Representative Fenton,
Madam Chair, I would echo in terms of applauding MnDOT for looking at some of this, but it is a patch. It is not the long-term solution. So what this bill will do is, in terms of a safety improvement, is look at the complete long-term fix to take care of the growing congestion, the growing safety hazards due to the growing number of cars and trucks and whatnot that are traveling through these roads here.
Okay, very good. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question for the author or someone from staff just regarding MnDOT and if they when was the last study that they did on this project. And if they hadn't done one, maybe they could give us shed off some light on what a cost like this normally would occur.
There's some background on that,
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. There is someone from MnDOT here. I'd like to just call them up to answer the question.
Very good. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Adam Josephson. I'm the East Area Manager for MnDOT, also currently working on the project for 2019 to redo the interchange. You asked a question about similar studies. It really depends on the scope of the study. A good example might be the 35W 494 interchange, which we just completed a study on. That was approximately $1 million study. It took a year and a half to complete.
And would this be a similar scope and magnitude, do you suppose?
Well, hearing from the testifiers today, I would think it would be maybe a bigger scope than I was originally thinking. So certainly could be of that magnitude. If the scope is a little more limited to maybe just a single flyover, it would be less than that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Fenton?
Madam Chair, thank you. There was a fiscal note requested, which came back at $250,000.
Okay, great. Representative Bernardi.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McDonald, do you have a follow-up and you want me to wait?
What would you like? You want to follow up, Representative?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi has the floor at this point. I'll wait until
okay.
She's finished.
I saw some movement right, over
Representative
there.
Representative Bernardi.
I did have a follow-up.
You're getting excited. Okay. Representative Fenton, I was wondering, was that fiscal note for the one facility, or was it for more facilities? Would it grow if another flyover, as you're calling it?
Representative Fenton.
The fiscal note was simply for the safety improvement as study, as this bill is written, is what it was for.
All right. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the MnDOT gentleman, based on the scope of the project, the bill that is at hand, have you been able to read that, and does that give you enough information to determine the scope of the bid?
Mr. Josephson, was it?
Yes. Members of the committee, reading through the bill, it is fairly generic, I think, as far as looking at safety improvements for the interchange. I said that could be a very wide range of things that we'd end up looking at. If we're looking at truly a long-term vision for it, I think a more expansive study would be needed. If we're looking at some shorter-term types of improvements, like a single flyover, I think it could be more limited in scope. But right now, the wording to me is fairly generic. We'll have to work with the cities and the counties and the other representatives out there to find out really what they would like to see studied, and then we would determine the scope from that point.
Representative Fenton?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative McDonald, I think as this bill is moving on, I think that the county and the city can come together with MnDOT to provide clarity if needed as the bill continues to be a work in progress.
All right, thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're doing the study, as I'm listening to all this, would it be possible to divide this up into a short-term improvement that is incorporated into long-term improvements? Sometimes you can add the lane on the flyovers, and that would be 2 years, 3 years down the road, then do something else that would just be part of the improvements in a continual thing. Would that be something you'd be looking at?
Mr. Josephson, I do think the bill is moving on. Representative to the Finance Division, and I think that they're going to want maybe some more detail specifics in order to get the cost right. But did you want to comment?
Yes. The example I mentioned at 35W and 494, that looked at the long-term vision and then also looked at a staged approach, which I think is what you're getting at. The first stage of the project would add a flyover ramp from north to west. I think there's another bill passing through maybe in this committee for $85 million for that improvement, but that would be a first phase of that particular implementation plan.
All right, thank you. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I see that there was something scheduled, and that was in the 2016 bill, which obviously we didn't get through last time. But just so that I understand this, there's some major work that's going to be done on the intersection. So is this something you're trying to get done before that is done?
Representative Fenton?
When, Madam Chair, Representative Mason, when I first dropped this bill, there was nothing in writing in terms of any sort of fix for this safety improvement. So right now, the fix would be, as we heard from our testifiers, more of a patch to just improve it for a little bit. The study, what we want is a long-term vision on how to do this right for long-term, for the long-term growth, planning, and continual growth of traffic at this interchange.
Any follow-up, Representative Mason?
No, only I hope that we can get votes to get the bonding and the transportation bill done. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Josephson, could you maybe just give the committee a little bit of a background on the general planning for major interchanges like this? And Representative Benton, you're doing a good job of noticing a congested corridor in your district, so thank you for bringing the bill. But just more generally, Mr. Josephson, can you give the committee just kind of where does MnDOT, how do they kind of plan these things out, and how does this bill different from the normal planning that MnDOT might normally do?
Mr. Josephson.
Madam Chair, Representative Koznick, our base need going, well, as it's mentioned, we have some funding issues obviously at hand, so our general strategy in the department is getting to be more and more preservation based. So our initial need looking at this interchange was to address the condition of the two bridges, basically replacing the bridge decks. But in order to do that, you kind of open up a big can of worms, I guess. So we were able, and fortunately able, to get some additional federal funds to expand the scope significantly to address not only the bridge condition, but some of the other safety and mobility issues we have here. I would also mention that there is a study being planned at the Met Council to look at all of the system interchanges within the metropolitan area and start trying to better define what the full needs are for these types of improvements, and then also give some regional look at what, if money did become available, how those funds might get spread around the or the region to implement some of those types of improvements.
Very good. All right. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to comment on the bill? Okay. Seeing no one else, do you have any final comments, Representative Fenton?
Madam Chair, members, I thank you for your time and ask for your support of this bill. And with that, I renew my motion for House File 135 to be referred to Transportation Finance.
Very good. All right. Let's see. Those in favor of House File 135?
Aye.
Oh. Okay. All right. Well, the record will be corrected. I guess it's my motion.
Oh, not your Madam Chair. Pardon me. Sorry.
No problem. All right. All in favor of House File 135, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Nay. Those opposed, same sign. Okay. Motion does prevail. House 135 is on its way. Thank you very much. And who do we have next? Okay, so next up we have Representative Heintzman in House File 192. Representative, welcome to the committee, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, yeah, please proceed and describe your bill for us. Okay, I'll move House File 192.
Say. Thank you, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
First, thanks for the opportunity to bring this bill back to the committee. And I was hoping if it would be possible if analyst Matt Burris could briefly describe some of the contents of the bill.
Okay, Mr. Burris, please describe the bill, if you would, please.
Madam Chair and members, House File 192 deals with a penalty enhancement, actually a couple of different penalty enhancements in situations where somebody is convicted of driving without a valid license, and it's those situations where somebody had a valid license to begin with but lost driving privileges. So there are various scenarios in which driving privileges can be lost, so they're kind of a different set of driver's license statuses, ranging from cancellation to revocation, as well as disqualification in the case of being able to operate some commercial motor vehicles. But essentially, it's lost driving privileges in all of those cases. And there are a couple of penalty enhancements that the bill would propose, and it would be increasing the penalty from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor. One of the situations where that penalty increase would take place under the bill is if a person violated the driving without privileges prohibition and caused a collision that resulted in substantial bodily harm or death. and substantial bodily harm is one of the later kind of levels in the criminal code of in personal injury. The other basic penalty enhancement would occur on repeat offenses, so a third or subsequent violation of driving without the privileges within a 10-year period of time would result in a gross misdemeanor. The bill also includes a couple of minimum sentence fine amounts as part of the penalty. So this would be for repeat offenses, so that a minimum penalty of $750 would be in place for a second conviction, and a similar minimum of $1,500 would be in place for third or subsequent convictions, and those would be convictions of any of the driving without privileges or driving after privileges have been removed. And then there's also a provision for cases when somebody is where the penalty would cause undue hardship, so a court could instead require community service work in lieu of the penalty.
Representative, do you have some testifiers here for your bill?
Madam Chair, I do not have anybody at the moment, but there may be some folks that want to speak to the bill once I finish. This bill came to me from a constituent, like a lot of legislation does. It was directly in a response to a case where Sue Vanek's daughter, Macy, was hit by a driver who'd had his license suspended or revoked a total of, I think, 12 or 13 times. No alcohol was involved, no other circumstances that would have allowed for an enhanced penalty. And the frustration from both my constituent and from the courts were that there were no other sentencing guidelines that could have allowed them for a stricter penalty. So we're revisiting this issue, I think, to look for a potential change that could remedy that.
All right. Representative Hertas, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Heinzman, thanks for bringing this forward. It's something that we certainly all care about and want to make sure that people are not violating that order when they have their driver's license revoked. That being said, though, I just want to point out to committee members that there is a problem that exists in the criminal justice system with regard to people who have revocations of their license, and getting that license reinstated, oftentimes they're able to do so rather quickly, but they're found to be an impediment of that reinstatement by some extraordinarily high reinstatement fees or charges. And many of the poorest of our community and those who really are facing difficulties in terms of how they get to work, how they're going to pay for rent, make the conscious decision in the absence of any money to drive on that license and get back to work and feed their children and their families. So my point is I think we need to look at those circumstances in which people are deemed not inimical to public safety and are able to have their licenses reinstated but can't do so because it requires $300 cash payment or something of that matter. We need to do something to be able to allow these people to legally drive if they're not inimical or a threat to public safety, and not make them a victim of the snare of the law in terms of being a repeat offender.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, that's a similar question that I have as Representative Hertas. I had the honor of being able to help a constituent in my district, actually two of them the last 2 years, that had their license revoked, but should have been not revoked, should have been reinstated, but because of the Department of Public Safety, there was a glitch and a misunderstanding. So fortunately, I was able to make a call to the Department of Public Safety, and the people there noticed the error and contacted my constituent and got the remedy, the problem solved. And it did in such a timely manner. So the Department of Public Safety really does a great job, but nobody's perfect. So under your bill, I'm just wondering, in that event that they were pulled over and their license was revoked, but in my circumstance, there was a mistake made and it shouldn't have been revoked, does this bill give the opportunity for the court to decide not to have the misdemeanor when it says the person has been given notice of or reasonably should know of the cancellation? maybe even staff could direct that question. Would that be enough evidence for the judge to not charge a misdemeanor under that line? Does that allow that judge the tools to not give that verdict?
Representative, why don't we see if Mr. Burris has some clarification for us?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I would be hesitant to speak for how a judge might analyze that kind of situation, but would tend to think that there's some flexibility built into the language of the current law, as you had pointed out, around having notice or a person reasonably knowing. One thing I would note is a distinction between the judge actually convicting someone and the charge being placed in the first place. I mean, there would be two different steps in the process, and so the bringing of the charge by the prosecutor at county or city level might actually, you know, be the stage at which this kind of issue could resolve itself before there's actually a court case. So if the charge is dropped, that would settle the matter right then and there. But kind of getting back to your scenario of if it did go to a judge, I would tend to think that there would be some flexibility. There is judicial discretion covering that kind of territory in general terms.
Right. Representative Bernardi. Okay. And Representative Uwakem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask a few questions of the author, but quick clarification maybe with what Mr. Burris just said, the difference between the charge and then what the person's convicted of, doesn't that charge still go on their record? That can be looked up when there's a criminal background check, even though they've been convicted of a lower charge, so the gross misdemeanor would still be on there. I'm trying to remember if that's the case or not.
Mr.
Kind of
Burris.
Going along the line to what Representative Hertaus was talking about with collateral sanctions.
Madam Chair, Burris. Representative Joachim, I'm not sure about that. I would have to look into it and get back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's one of my worries, is what Representative Hertaus kind of eloquently explained, and the fact that when someone's trying to reinstate their license after driving after revocation, they have to pay cash and all in one lump sum unless they qualify for a public defender, then they can divide it in half. So I get a little worried about having folks that can't afford it then driving again just so they can get to work to pay the bills, and Representative Hertaus explained that quite well. One question on the raising of the penalty, does that include the $250 surcharge a court can charge to reinstate the license, so it would be $250 on top of the $1,500, or is that rolled in? Or on top of the $750, as the case may be?
Representative Heinzman.
Madam Chair, Representative, a couple of things have been brought up, and I want to make a clarification. Representative McDonald had mentioned a revocation, and over the course of the last few months and the previous biennium, as we've introduced this bill, there's been some confusion in regard to suspension versus revocation. There's a big difference. And a lot of times folks use those two terms interchangeably, and there are two distinct different things. And House research could maybe speak to that. But I just wanted to point out that there is a very significant difference in the issue that Representative Joachim is bringing up in terms of the cost. My understanding is that $1,500 is the maximum at that stage, but if I hear anything different, I can come back and let your office know.
Representative Joachim?
It looks like Mr. Burris may have an answer for us, because I was a little confused, because in Subdivision 2 they do talk about revocation, and then the underlying added language except as otherwise provided in Subdivision 5. So maybe Mr. Burris can enlighten us.
Mr. Burris, I know we're not the Public Safety Committee here, but we'll try.
Madam Chair, Representative Joachim, yes, the penalty enhancement changes, both on when it's enhanced to a gross misdemeanor and on the fines, would apply to the various driving after loss of driving privileges. So suspension is included as well as revocation. And then to the question on the fine amount, I would read this as being a fine that does not include the court surcharge. Generally, that's added on as another fine component. So just backing up a step, the overall structure for fine, for citation fines for traffic as well as other areas of state law is that there's a base fine that is generally set by the courts but can be set through law, such as minimums that are proposed in this bill. And then a court surcharge is added on to that amount in general. And there's also a small law library fee. That court surcharge, other than parking fines, is $75. So the $250 amount that you mentioned, I'm not quite sure where you might be getting that from.
Representative Uwakum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On subdivision, our statute 171.29, subdivision 2, number C, they have a $50. Oh, that's the traumatic brain injury. But no, under that section of law on 171.29, it does talk about $250 surcharge after revocation up to a certain amount of times it's revoked. So, and I only know about that because we got, because there's a great $50 part of that surcharge that goes to the Traumatic Brain Injury Foundation, which traumatic brain injuries happen a lot with these crashes. So I just wanted, my point was to make sure people understood that the fine was there, but then there's also a surcharge on top of that and other court fees on top of that, that if I know Representative Hertas had to step out, but I think he'd kind of agree with me that can end up digging people down a hole if they don't get it, don't get their license reinstated right away because they can't afford to pay the fine in cash all at once up front. And then another question for Mr. Burris. The 10-year, 3 and 10 years, is that common in statute in other traffic violations, or is it usually is it 3 and 10 years or 3 and 3 years on most violations that is counted on your record? We have a lot of three-strike rules within traffic fines. I'm new to traffic. To transportation policy, so maybe you could just remind me on that.
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Joachim, on that question, I'm offhand, I don't recall very many cases where subsequent second or third subsequent offenses in the world of traffic violations yields a penalty increase. I'd have to go back and look through, but really not very many are coming to mind. I do believe that it is more common in other areas of the criminal code, okay, which is kind of in general not a field I'm as well versed in. Just interested in that. If I also might, Madam Chair, going back to your $250, that's one piece of a larger fine that's significantly higher than the usual fine structure, as you noted. That's specific to DUI reinstatements. Right. That's not a general fine that's imposed when somebody's license is suspended or canceled. In general, there is a broader provision on reinstatement fees that's also in that section that's a lower amount. It's $20 or $30. And I would need to wrap my head around that again to make sure I get the right details behind it, but it's a $30 fee that I think generally applies for reinstatement on a canceled license, and that is a fee amount that's in addition to the fine structure that I described earlier.
Representative Uwakum.
Madam Chair, Mr. Burris, thank you so much. I was unsure about that, so I thank you so much for your clarification. And Representative Heitzman, it's not that I don't like your bill, because I understand getting bills from constituents and reading Macy's story. It sounded absolutely horrific what happened to her and what her family's been having to deal with. So the only other last question I have, considering Macy's story in particular, because her injuries were so severe, and I understand she's still not doing well, wondering why you had picked substantial bodily harm versus great bodily harm. Because with substantial bodily harm, it could actually mean just a fractured bone as well. So I can understand wanting to make it much more severe when grave injuries happen. So I was just wondering why you hadn't thought about great bodily harm instead.
Representative Heinzman.
Madam Chair, Representative Yoakum. I think that part of what can get lost in this discussion is the victim. And in Macy's case, she's in a persistent vegetative state. And while on one hand we want to be very careful, and I respect that, I understand, and that might be a good opportunity for me once again to go back to the difference between suspension versus revocation. Suspensions can happen and are triggered by a number of pretty common mistakes that people make in traffic or in regard to their vehicle. And we connected those two because I think it's still important. Revocation is something that would typically happen in a more serious situation. And focusing the bill on making sure that victims' rights are recognized here too. And if you're driving a vehicle with a revoked or suspended driver's license and you drive off the road and break somebody's arm, I think it's reasonable fracture, in some cases vegetative state. Someone needs to be advocating for those folks.
All right.
Madam Chair, one more.
Representative Wakeham.
Representative Heitzman, I do agree with you, and I understand the severity of the injuries, and we do need to be looking at people that are constantly driving without revocation or suspension, which this bill addresses both. But I would just ask you, maybe as the bill moves through the process, to look at that statute, the definition for substantial versus great, and I think you can accomplish what you're accomplishing, want to accomplish, especially for Macy. Having that definition be great bodily harm instead of substantial, because substantial can go down. There's a big difference between a broken arm and a permanent vegetative state, and I want to make sure that we're just thoughtfully thinking of it. So thank you.
Right. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Okay. Seeing no one, then I'm going to renew the motion for House File 192 to be recommended and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. So, let's see. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Okay. The bill does pass, and it'll move on to the Committee on Public Safety, Security Policy and Finance. Great. Thank you, Mr. Representative Heinzman. Okay. Next, we have House File 257. We are awaiting the author at this point. So, we have not heard from Representative Anderson, so we thought we would hear a response and know her timing and so on, but we don't want to keep folks in their valuable time. So we'll move that bill on to the next committee hearing. Oh, there she is, in the nick of time. All right. Welcome, Representative Anderson. Just in time. Okay, so, and we have House File 257, And I'll move House File 257 and recommend that it move on to the Committee on Transportation Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson. Members, what this bill does is it allows for retired law enforcement to have a special license plate, much like retired firefighter has as well. And I have with me a constituent that is willing to testify, and I can keep my comments brief to respect your time.
Okay, very good. Welcome, sir, and please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
It's an honor and privilege to speak to the committee today. My name is Paul Bierhaus, and I live in Plymouth, Minnesota. I spent 12 years in civilian law enforcement as a narcotics and then a homicide detective in Wichita, Kansas, with the Sheriff's Department before being wounded and then leaving law enforcement. Additionally, I spent 10 years as a senior law enforcement officer in the military. I was a provost marshal in the Army. Currently, I serve at the pleasure of the Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek on his Community Advisory Board and have done so for the last 6 years, so my fingers are still in law enforcement. After my years in law enforcement, I became a business owner here in Minnesota, but law enforcement is still in my blood, as it is to most of us who have served in law enforcement. As I see what's going on in our country these days and our quickness to blame police officers for so many things that they do in the course of their career, I'm reminded that every day a police officer leaves his home not knowing that he's going to return alive or well that evening. It's a dangerous world out there, and they are sworn to risk their lives for the good of society and the protection of life, and we cannot say enough thank yous to our law enforcement community. As such, I think we as a nation, we as a state, in every way possible, need to honor the commitment of those who serve and protect. And just last year in the United States, 140 officers did just that by losing their lives in the line of duty. Which brings me to why I'm here today. I believe it's appropriate that we, as a state, say thank you to all those who have served as police officers by allowing them to proudly proclaim themselves as retired police officers. One way to do that is to provide them with an opportunity to do just that by having a special retired police officer license plate for the vehicles, showing that the state recognizes their years of service to the communities. This is not out of the norm. The state of Minnesota provides license plates for firefighters, retired firefighters, EMS, and I believe retired EMS technicians. We even have special license plates for 93 different situations, including 38 people in the state of Minnesota who have a citizen fan license operators. We have a license plate for them. We also obviously, and so justifiably so, honor those who've served in the military in many different ways, with Silver Stars, Medal of Honors, Bronze Stars, and the different wars and conflicts we've been in, and that's justifiably so also. But conspicuously missing is honoring those who also sacrifice their lives and put their lives on the risk every day, and that's our police officers. This is not unheard of in the United States. We will be joining the ranks of several states, much like Illinois, New York, Louisiana, Florida, North, South Carolina, to name just a few, who do have special retired police officer license plates. Like I said, we have 93 special license plates recognizing those who have served in the military and else. We also recognize the pride that we have in colleges and universities. Every college and university in the state of Minnesota has their own license plate. And as I looked through the list of 93 earlier, there are some schools that have like 3, 4, or 5 people. So we're honoring a very small number, but yet justifiably so. I just believe that we need to do something to honor the lifelong service of those law enforcement officers, many of whom have given their lives in their services, just like many of those who served in the military. So I'm asking the Minnesota legislature to pass H.R. 257 and direct the commissioner to issue retired law enforcement plates as soon as that could possibly happen. And I thank Representative Anderson and Torkelson for bringing this bill forward.
Very good. Thank you. Any comments from the committee at this point? Representative Mason?
Just one comment. I've served on the Transportation Committee for many years and typically have been voting against most specialty plates because my understanding is law enforcement didn't like all the variety. And I know, as you said, we have a lot, and usually they kind of skirt around the Transportation Committee, and that's why we have so many. And you make a valid point. I mean, we do have a lot, but again, it's as I said, because it's normally because law enforcement is the one that I thought was against all the specialty plates. It's an interesting dilemma. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Mason. You know, when Paul came to me, Mr. Beerhouse came to me with this issue, I knew that it was an issue that he didn't take lightly, and obviously he's done his homework on the issue itself. And I was reminded that I was having this hearing on Sunday as I was driving around town in Plymouth, and here I see this Golden Gopher license plate. And to me, it just really highlighted the fact if we can do it for the Golden Gophers, certainly we can do it for those that are wishing to have this as part of their vehicle. I think it's a small request to make.
All right. A question, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for bringing the bill forward. My question is more maybe for staff, unless the author knows, Representative Anderson, but what is the cost to produce these special plates, and do the fees generally cover them, or how does that work? Or maybe I'm in the wrong transportation committee again. It should be in finance, but if we have those answers, I'd be curious. Thank you.
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, I don't have specific answers for you on that. The fiscal note will lay out some of the cost information. I could note, though, that there is a $10 fee that would go along with this plate. That's a standard fee as far as other special plates. And my understanding is, in general, that fee amount is roughly matching the production cost. In the past, fiscal notes for proposed special plates have identified an administrative startup cost. I don't know if that trend will continue with fiscal notes, with considering the new MNLAR system as it starts to be up and running. But that would be a cost, the possibility that I would anticipate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question related to this bill. I was just wondering, are you going to hear all of the proposed driver license plate bills? And I'm asking because I happen to have one for World War II veterans so that they can use handicap parking if needed. What are your thoughts on moving forward with these types or similar bills?
You know, I haven't looked at all of them, and you know, maybe there are some criteria we would want to have in place, although I recall a very long discussion in Transportation Committee about 4 years ago on this very subject. So I think, as Mr. Burris says, we aren't looking at tremendous costs of reproducing them anymore. So it doesn't appear that there's a tremendous investment that we make. So it seems like we should take a look at them.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
For their merit. All right. Any other questions? Anyone from the audience wish to comment on the bill? All right, hearing none, we will proceed to the vote. Did you have a final comment yourself, Representative Anderson?
No, Madam Chair. I just appreciate your support.
Okay, very good. And so I will renew my motion that House File 257 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And we have no other business before the committee today, so we are adjourned until Wednesday.
Yeah.
Thank you.